You're listening to Midori House, first broadcast on the 19th of April 2017 on Monocle 24. Hello and welcome to Midori House, coming to you live from Studio One here in London. I'm Andrew Muller on today's show.
I will be taking out to the country in this campaign a proud record of a Conservative government.
Here we go again. The UK braces itself for its fourth major electoral contest in as many years. But how will Theresa May's snap election be seen from abroad? My guests Xenia Wickett and Tim Marshall will be here to discuss that and the day's other big stories, including another day of protest in Venezuela. How many more can President Nicolas Maduro stand? Donald Trump passes his first electoral test as president, for the moment at least. And where in the world is the USS Carl Vinson? That's all coming up on Midori House on Monocle 24 right now. And welcome to the show. My guests today are Xenia Wickett, head of the US and Americas program at Chatham House, and Tim Marshall, editor of the whatandthewhy.com, former diplomatic editor of Sky News. Welcome both. And we will start here in the UK, where today MPs have voted overwhelmingly to endorse Prime Minister Theresa May's call for a snap early general election on June the 8th. Although, given the relative state of the government and opposition parties, this may seem akin to George Custer's 7th Cavalry enthusiastically agreeing to meet the Lakota Nation on the banks of the Little Bighorn. It will also mean that the normally proverbially staid and stolid politics of Great Britain have erupted in their fourth rancorous and divisive electoral contest, I'm anticipating, in as many years. I think it's four. I'm beginning to lose count. Xenia, first of all, it does seem a little counterintuitive that Labour queued up to vote with the government for this early election. They are going to get massacred. Is it possible that many of the parliamentary Labour Party actually kind of welcome a sort of cleansing fire at this point?
I think it's very possible. If you, British politics is in some ways not dissimilar right at the moment from American politics, which is a little scary thought, but nevertheless, which is to say that you have a leader who is not necessarily supported by a vast number of the politicians. So in the United States, we saw very vividly over the last year, Donald Trump not really supported by much of the Republican Party. He's now president. He's still not supported by most of the congressional leaders in Republican leaders, members of Congress and members of the Senate. Here in the UK, you've got in opposition Jeremy Corbyn, who, as far as I can tell, I'm still looking for the Labour MP that supports Jeremy Corbyn. So, I mean,
there are several, I believe.
Allegedly so, but not the ones I appear to be talking to. So I think there is fundamentally something happening in American politics and in British politics. There is a, you know, and we can kind of go through all of the typical kind of adages, you know, there is a move to the extremes. There is a desire for something different. There is a desire to shake things up. What's happened before isn't working today, isn't working for a whole sector of society, and so therefore they're voting for something. I mean, all of these things are very, very true, but as a result of which you end up with the population, in the case of the United States, voting for something that the politicians don't necessarily support, and you appear to have the same thing in this country as well at the moment.
Tim, if she does win, as is generally anticipated, and wins quite handsomely, does that strengthen her negotiating position in terms of the Brexit negotiations, especially if, as many people suspect and or hope, depending on inclination, she personally actually favours the softer end of Brexit?
That is the entire raison d'être. You see what I did there?
I did. You brought a continental European language into this discussion.
It's the entire raison d'etre of why she has called it. It's all about Brexit. She wishes to go to the country saying it's about Brexit. Now, look, the electorate can make their own minds up whether it's about the economy or defence or whatever, but in fact, Brexit is about everything. And so, even if it's the economy, it's about Brexit. So, she has gamed it out that, okay, I could easily hang on till 2020 and probably win, but by 2020 we'll have been out of the EU at least a year, and if it's negative, things will be starting to kick in, and that might put me in a bad position.
And also by then, Labour may have a different leader.
It's possible. If she goes now, then she's got 5 years of power, and crucially, she will have almost certainly an increased majority, therefore strengthening her hand. And this is what the election slogans will be about. They'll say, make me stronger so I can make you stronger when I go to Brussels and kick their butts.
I can totally see that on a poster.
And cooperate and negotiate with my European partners, is what I meant to say.
The only thing I would add is, and I think kind of Tim laid this out, it is absolutely about Brexit. It's also about Theresa May. I mean, you know, let's not forget that not only does this strengthen, yes, absolutely, her hand in the discussions with the Europeans, but it also gives her an extra two. He gives her own mandate. It strengthens her in Parliament. It strengthens her own position. So, I mean, she happens to have come across a win-win as far as she's concerned, and it makes a lot of sense so far. Unless, of course, she doesn't win quite as well as people anticipate, in which case, you know, still to be seen.
Well, she was presumably also thinking not only are Labour in no fit state, she can probably marginalise and or destroy UKIP. She may be able to take some lumps out of the SNP in Scotland under a revived Conservative Party led by Ruth Davidson. But, Tim, there are a couple of wild cards. There always are where elections are concerned. Is it possible that there is a James Comey moment looming in the Crown Prosecution Service dumping on Tory MPs and their agents who may or may not have fiddled their expenses in the last election?
No.
Okay, well, that was a long run for a short slide, that question and answer.
No, because it's going to be dropped now until after the general election.
CPS says it won't.
Well, okay, I say it will. And I don't know who has more authority here, me or the CPS. But it's a little bit like the opposition in Turkey want the votes recounted, but Erdogan doesn't. Do you think the votes are going to be recounted?
Probably not.
Exactly. So you didn't have to read all the European newspapers. I went through them today, Andrew. And I was surprised at just how much coverage there was. Corriere della Sera, lead story front page. El Pais, lead story front page. Frankfurter Allgemeine, lead story front page. And it's in all the European papers. Because they get this is not just another British election. You know, this is a British election about the future of not just Britain, but the EU. Sorry, but you didn't ask me that question. To answer your question, I already have. I just think this is going to be parked. This alleged scandal about election expenses will be parked until after the election. We'll find out.
Just a final thought on this one from you, Xenia. In general, will the rest of the EU be welcoming the idea of negotiating with Theresa May with a large mandate of her own, or will they think they now have a slightly smaller opportunity to give Britain a bit of a kicking on its way out?
I think most of the press that I've seen, the European press that I've seen, continental European press, we are, of course, still in Europe, the continental European press that I've seen.
You betray yourself.
For the time being, we are. Has actually been pretty positive about it. You know, actually, you know, yes, she'll have a stronger mandate, most likely, but she'll also be in a strong position to actually negotiate. There's a bit of predictability. Predictability is very good. That's what people are looking for. So I think for the vast majority of the kind of mainstream press, they're all quite supportive of this idea that actually she'll be negotiating from a stronger position domestically. And there's much less uncertainty about the future if this election goes through. There are some who've, you know, implied that, although mostly the British press have implied that actually suddenly if she wins, Britain will be in a much stronger negotiating position and Europe will be in a much weaker negotiating position. And I just kind of go, really? Really? I don't know quite how you get to that. But of course, there are European elections coming up. So France, Germany, later the EU, before the end of these negotiations. So it isn't all over.
It is not. But let's move along for the moment, because British listeners who believe that they have been consigned by recent events into life as citizens of a chaotic, tempestuous banana republic may avail themselves of an invigorating dose of corrective by reading recent reports from Venezuela. Further huge demonstrations against the hapless government of President Nicolas Maduro are planned for today. 11 other Latin American countries have signed a communique urging Caracas to guarantee the right of peaceful protest. This hint has has not been gratefully received. Tim, we're starting to see footage on social media of today's demonstrations. They look huge. Today is a holiday in Venezuela, celebrating the beginning of another independence movement in 1810. Are we potentially at another tipping point? Might this date be celebrated twofold in coming years?
Possibly. I think this year will be. I mean, I don't know if this is the tipping point, but it is part of the tipping point. I do not think the government of Maduro can last the year. And unfortunately, there's a distinct possibility that it'll end in violence. Now, so far, you've got a massive, massive demonstration in Caracas today, and there's 20 other cities where it's taking part. Maduro has actually said publicly, I'm going to give 500,000 rifles to the militias, even though that's unconstitutional. I mean, you know, he is setting the tone. The colectivos, these are these motorcycle gangs and other thugs that roam around the cities, which are on his side because they're on the payroll at the moment, are out. So you do have the potential for a very, very nasty clash. He means to maintain the Bolivarian revolution. He means to maintain the Chavez, Hugo Chavez's reputation and his place in history. But the country is increasingly economically bankrupt, divided and undemocratic, and it's hard to see ending peacefully, and this is the biggest demonstration so far.
Xenia, that communique I mentioned, 11 other Latin American countries urging him to respect the right to peaceful process, is that the rest of Latin America getting as close as they dare to instructing one of their fellow leaders to push quietly off?
Yes, it's probably as far as it gets. It's certainly not going to get any further. And will it be ignored? Yes, it will absolutely be ignored. I mean, one of the... If the others, and I put that in inverted commas, sorry, this is radio, you can't see it. If the others actually were to come together and actually, you know, take economic action, something of that nature, could they put pressure? Yes, absolutely they could. Are they going to do that? No, absolutely they're not. In part because there are ones amongst them who don't want to set a precedent. They don't think that imposing themselves in another sovereign country's state is something that they necessarily want others to do with them. So, I mean, you see this around the world. You know, you see this absolutely in the Middle East. You see this in Asia. A real resistance for countries in the region to actually call upon their neighbours to actually take action and impose pressure. And I don't see that this is going to be any different. But I actually have a question for Tim, if I might.
Oh, dear. Please.
Oh, dear. Which is, you know, you say that you think this year may be the tipping point. But my question is, how does that play out? Because, you know, who replaces him? How do you get a change in Venezuela?
Well, chaos, chaos may replace him.
Okay,
that's still a tipping point.
Okay, so you're not talking about a move from Maduro to another opposition leader.
I hope so. But at the moment, I don't see that Maduro would give way. Therefore, you only have three other scenarios. One, popular uprising, which is peaceful, and he goes away.
Unlikely.
I doubt that very much.
Yeah.
The status quo. And I just think after a certain number of years, things, you know, the centre cannot hold. And I think this year might be the year that the centre doesn't hold. Or the third one is a descent into chaos. I came across a little factoid today which reminded me of just what a... You said Banana Republic, Andrew, in the introduction.
I mean, did.
It is becoming a Banana Republic in many, many ways. People are having to go across borders to buy food.
This is, of course, a country we should remind ourselves...
Oil rich.
...which has no excuse not to be extremely wealthy, orderly and prosperous.
Exactly. Now...
And arguably was heading that direction, decade plus ago.
The metro has been closed. A third of stations today, the busiest stations, have been closed for maintenance because it's a public holiday. Now, what a coincidence. You know, as if the government hasn't got the, look, will you please close all the metro stations so no one can get to the demo? It's that sort of Banana Republic basket case that you just think they're getting to the end of the road.
But just to follow that up, Tim, how much of the problem is the one man? If Maduro was to step aside for, you know, in one way or another, are there likely... more plausible, more coherent, more organised figureheads within the Chavista movement who could take over from him.
The opposition leader keeps being sent to prison. But there are, you know, there's always ways and means. I mean, Nelson Mandela was in prison and people were talking to him. So there are ways and means that if there are people who are grown up enough to realise that this can't go on, and you can negotiate a way out where suddenly, oh, look, Mr. Madero's incommunicado and no one's picking up the phone to help him. You know, like the way Milosevic was pushed out of Serbia. Basically, there was a massive demonstration. And the only thing that, which was normal, but what Milosevic didn't know was that everybody had decided, you know what, when he rings us up and says, get the riot police out, I'm not going to answer the phone. And the army, I'm not going to come on the streets. So if you can concoct a scenario like that, which is perfectly plausible, then there is a way out. But he and the people around him are hell-bent in staying exactly where they are. And they say to save the Bolivarian socialist revolution, which has lifted many people out of poverty. And a few years ago, you might have made a case for that. Now it's a complete basket case.
Okay, we're going to take a short break now. You're listening to Midori House here with me, Andrew Miller, Xenia Wickett and Tim Marshall. Coming up next, Donald Trump's first electoral test as president and the armada that wasn't.
Hello, I'm Steve Bloomfield and I want to tell you about an exciting event we've got coming up. On the 11th of May, we'll open the doors of Midori House here in London for a special episode of The Foreign Desk with a live audience. Up for discussion? French election.
The problem is they've got to have somebody to vote for, and the choice will be between the National Front and a Conservative candidate. But this is where the implosion of the left really is, I think, the tragedy for France at the moment.
With an expert panel of guests, including journalist and author Jonathan Fenby and the AFP's London Bureau Chief Florence Biederman, we'll ask not only what the election could mean for the future of France, but also for Europe in the age of rising populism.
She presents herself as a kind of Jeanne d'Arc in a way, you know, like a national heroine who defends the country. But in what she doesn't say, she eliminates so many things.
We'll have the results. We've got the panel. All we need now is you. If you'd like to be in the audience, head to monocle.com to get your tickets today. That's The Foreign Desk Live on Thursday, the 11th of May at 1900 with me, Steve Bloomfield.
You are back with Midori House on Monocle 24 with me, Andrew Muller. Still with me are Xenia Wickett and Tim Marshall. Now, regular readers of the social media outbursts of US President Donald Trump may have been puzzled yesterday by a series of blurts typed with his tiny orange thumbs into his solid gold phone, traducing the name of John Ossoff, a 30-year-old documentary filmmaker. The reason was that Ossoff was the Democratic candidate in a special election in Georgia's 6th Congressional District, the seat recently vacated by incoming Health Secretary Tom Price, previously held for several geological epochs by Republican grandee Newt Gingrich. Xenia, he nearly did it as well. 48.1% in the first round in a field of 11. There is now a two-person runoff on June 20th. Can he win it?
Of course he can win it. Will he win it? Probably not. I mean, you know, you have to remember what he was really working towards was to avoid a runoff, which meant that he would have had to get 50%. There were 18 other candidates in the race. So, you know, the other candidates shared the other 3% of the vote. The reality is that when it becomes Ossoff against the leading Republican candidate, Karen Handel, former Georgia Secretary of State, you know, applied to have the Senate seat, applied for all sorts of things, hasn't succeeded, but she is a credible Republican candidate, and the chances are that the other 52 plus will end up voting for her and she will win. That being said, you know, all that being said, 2 months into the Trump presidency, a seat that is, I mean, this is Newt Gingrich's seat. I mean, this is solidly Republican. The fact that a Democratic 30-year-old can actually get 48%+ of the vote, even in a first round, is really quite stupendous and should be sending messages. Now, you know, you've got some of the papers who are saying, the Democrats, you know, that you've got the midterms in November of next year and the Democrats could win the, I think it's 24 seats that they require to take back the House. I think that's probably, that would be a stretch. But 2 months in, you know, Trump is not going through any kind of a honeymoon period. This should be seen as a referendum on him, and it is being seen as a referendum on him.
Tim, how big a fright is this for Donald Trump, or how big a fright should he consider it? As Xenia points out, the Georgia Sixth is that's a Republican banker if ever there was one.
I have to admit, I wasn't aware of this story until today, so I defer to a real expert. I mean, it's just something I hadn't followed. So, of course, it piqued my interest once I realised that you're interested in, and I looked into it. And before I looked into it, I'd have said the answer is yes, Mr. Trump would be quite worried about this. But A, you've just said you reckon in the second round, in the runoff, the votes of all the other candidates will pull together and keep it Republican. That's one thing. But I also looked at the demographics of the district. And the demographics of the district is young, college-educated, left-leaning. So given that there's been this, if you're not a Trump fan, something of a car crash of 100 days, and given that the 30-year-old candidate, apparently his campaign slogan was Make Trump Angry, mm-hmm. something like that.
Yeah.
I don't think it's that surprising. I think it was an opportunity for that section of the American public which loathes him to express that. But I don't think it therefore means that in the midterms suddenly Trump gets wiped out. So he a little concerned, but not really that scared.
I don't think Trump's going to be concerned at all.
Right.
But I think the Republican Party should be. Now, on the one hand, I mean, two things. One, Ossoff raised $8 million for this, which is way above what anybody else raised. So, you know, you're talking about a fair amount of money being willing to spend, people being willing to invest a fair amount of money on small races in, you know, parts of the United States that should be very, very clear Republican wins. The other reason that, so A, there's a lot of money here. B, it's the mere fact that that Republicans are now going to have to compete in every single race. They can no longer sit back and say, you know what, I don't need to spend money, I don't need to spend resources, I don't need to spend time in supporting this particular seat in this small congressional district in Tennessee or Idaho. Because the reality is, based on this, you know the Democrats are going to be competing for every single seat. And that means the Republicans are going to be spread incredibly thin. That is probably good for democracy. I mean, this is actually, I would argue, a very good sign.
Tim,
not that it's going to change the results, just for the record, but, you know.
Tim, you invoked there the fabled 100 days by which incoming presidents are already always measured. Mm. Trump, as he approaches that figure, is polling, his approval ratings are 41%.
I read a different poll, 50%.
This is Gallup.
One of them went,
Gallup is saying 41.
Oh, well, it's the Bible. Really, there are so many. Rasmussen always has him higher than Gallup, and I read one last week that's 50. I don't care.
50 is an outlier, and it's still not good.
I don't care either way.
It is still historic,
but I have interrupted your question.
But it is still historically low, is my point. So is the way forward then for the Democrats to basically run absolutely everything they can as a referendum on Donald Trump?
No, because people don't live in our world of being political geeks. You know, people live in a real world, and if things are, look, I mean, the world has not ended. A lot of this is froth. Have you noticed?
As we go to air,
news just in. Let me give you a small example. The media was concentrating yesterday on Donald Trump signing that little boy's hat. I don't know if you saw the social media.
I did.
Signs the boy's hat and just throws it in the air and walks off. Yeah, all right, the man's a whatever, I won't say on the radio. Sure.
There's actually some suspicion he was actually just throwing it back to the kid with a slight theatrical flourish.
Exactly. I think that's perfectly possible. That was the first thing I thought. Hang on. The point I'm making is that people are looking at the froth of Trump and not at the any meaning. And what he did before he signed that in behind a private door and what he did afterwards in private are far, far more important than this froth. And people are looking at Trump's froth, which I believe is your next story, and they're not looking at the substance. I think his polling ratings, 40%, I'm quite surprised. That's quite high.
Well, pollsters do generally reckon on the fact that there's always going to be about 27 or 28% unbudgeable.
Like even, and either way, he's like, got another 3 years,
like,
4 years.
Like, even if he just punched the Easter Bunny, there would still be 28%.
I don't know why doing that.
Well, it actually would have raised him a few notches in my own estimation. But finally tonight, you having queued this story up nicely for us, you may all recall the other week's apocalyptic panic about the possibility of a nuclear showdown between Kim Jong-un and Donald Trump, precipitated by the deployment of the U.S. SS Carl Vinson and its accompanying strike group to the waters off the Korean Peninsula. Trump called it an armada, very powerful. North Korea, a reckless act of aggression. It has now emerged that at the peak of the crisis, on April 15th, birthday of Kim Il-sung, the Carl Vinson strike group was 4,000 kilometres away and sailing in the opposite direction. Xenia, is this just left hand and right hand not getting each other's stories straight beforehand, or is something more sinister going on? I kind of wish there was, to be honest.
So let me give you two answers. The first is, you know, I agree absolutely, Tim. This is froth. You know, the armada, to use Trump's language, was sailing in one direction. You know, he talked about it sailing in another direction. The story is now, which direction was the armada again? I wish I could do inverted commas on radio. It makes so much more sense.
It was in kind of an actual different ocean.
Yes, but that isn't the bit that we should be focusing on. And this is where I agree with Tim. It's like, you know...
No one's ever
said
that before, by the way.
Sorry?
No one's ever said that before.
Well, there you go. There had to be a first at some point. You know, the right hand and the left hand. We assume bureaucracies are really organised and always getting
it
right. And they just... I've worked for them. Okay, fair enough. I've worked for them. They don't. I mean, this happens more often than it doesn't happen, where the right and the left are going in separate directions and never the twain shall meet. That isn't the story we should be talking about. The story that we should actually be talking about is, you know... Donald Trump was willing to send an aircraft carrier plus to the seas around North Korea to effectively threaten North Korea and, by the by, threaten China as well. You know, if you're not going to help out, then we're going to do it ourselves. What's the next step? Because in all of these things, whether you're talking about Venezuela or you're talking about North Korea, you know, my next question is, okay, what happens next? So the aircraft carrier gets into the seas around North Korea. Then what? Does Trump up the ante a little bit more? And, you know, potentially North Korea, Kim Jong-un actually says, oh, you know, I'm going to just respond in some form or another. I'm trying to be polite. You know, is it going to change the Chinese behavior? No, absolutely not. So are you actually starting an escalatory set of actions? You know, or does Donald Trump back down? You know, as arguably he did, you know, with the Chinese, oh, I'm going to question the One China policy. Oh, actually, no, the One China policy is okay. In which case, this is another example of Donald Trump backing down, and that's not good.
You do get yourself off the hook from having to back down if the strike group is actually heading towards Australia in the first place, I guess.
Look, Obama sent an entire strike group towards North Korea in his presidency, and nobody said he was a madman about to start World War III because they liked him. People hate this guy, and so they think he's a madman about to start World War III. The same policy, the same strike group. That's the first thing. The second thing is, I looked at what the Defense Department said. The Defense Department said that the aircraft carrier group would sail north and report on station to the Western Pacific Ocean. At no point did either the White House or the Defense Department say, we are sending an aircraft carrier to North Korea. At no point did they say that. They certainly were happy to give the impression they were doing that. That's going to concentrate minds, isn't it? And if the media want to run away with that story, and they even went so far, the media, as to say that the Reagan was on its way as well, and the Bremerton. Whereas, in fact, both of those are being refitted at the moment. And to their credit, the White House did push back against that. So, no, that's not happening. Yes, the White House did not make any effort to dissuade the media from what it had decided was the story, that the aircraft carrier was heading towards North Korea. But I challenge you to find a statement, and Trump's was the clearest, the most out there,
I'm sending an armada. He didn't say I'm sending an armada to North Korea.
No, I think I have to say to him, I mean, I think you are passing. It was
well, clear. You show me where they said they were going to send an aircraft carrier to North Korea. At no point did they say that. They were happy for the media to run with the story.
The implication with Donald Trump that he was sending an armada to North Korea was absolutely clear. The fact that he didn't spell it out in black and white, I think, is neither here nor there. There was absolutely no question on his mind what he was trying to say.
Concentrated minds. So,
but what happens next?
The same as when Obama did. They got away with it again.
He backs down. And then where will we be?
We may never know because we are out of time. Although I think it is worth noting that Sean Spicer, the White House's press secretary, said earlier today, that it was right to say or suggest that the ship was heading towards Korea because it will eventually.
I'm going to set off down the M1 in a few hours.
Indeed so. Tim Marshall and Xenia Wickett, thank you very much for joining us here at Midori House. That is all for today's show. It was produced by Carlotta Ribello, researched by Fernando Augusto Pacheco and Alexa Sogal. Our studio manager was Kieran Banerjee. More music next with Carlotta at 1900. Danny Giacopelli is in with the entrepreneurs, and I'll be back with more on the day's main stories on the daily at 2200. For now, I'm Andrew Muller. Thanks for listening.